Okay, so last day. Final exam is Tuesday at 8:30 in the morning, and we're going to have it in the lower strong. So the assignment's 106, and I'm going to have it fit to move it to the lower strong. Plenty of room to spread out there, I think. I've scheduled to have Bachelor 109 from 4 to 6 on Sunday for a pre-final exam question and answer session. Spirit of that is you can ask anyone, and I'll do my best to answer it in full. Sure, what is question 1 on the final? So, well, actually, I know the professor who actually gave, 10 questions in advance. He said, I'll pick some of these. It was actually a pretty good way to do it. I'll do that sometime. Anyway, you can do both sides, 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper, bring a calculator, sort of the same drill. You can expect it to be probably not quite twice as long, and you have more than twice the time. Yes. So not a silly question, it's AM. Yes. Not a silly question at all, because if you show up PM, you won't find me here. Okay, so there's that. So today what I wanted to do is finish up nuclear physics. So we'll talk about that for a little while, and at the end of the nuclear physics stuff, I'll say the word, and that's the end of material for the final. And then I'm going to want you to just put your pencils down and hold on, because I want to tell you what I think is some pretty cool stuff. And probably most of you wouldn't be in this class if you actually didn't think some of this stuff was going to be so cool. So I just want to tell you, sort of for completeness, I want to talk about particle physics and cosmology and some of how it ties together and some of the really weird things that people are talking about these days. So, okay. I sent out an email that has basically material coverage for the final and some email that wasn't clear. All right, so last time we talked about a lot of nuclear physics, and in the end, most of the interesting stuff in nuclear physics is driven by this particular curve, where we're plotting the binding energy per nucleon on this axis versus A here. Binding energy per nucleon is the energy that you release when you take the constituents and you put them together into a nucleus. So it's basically how much energy is effectively holding the thing together.
Why does fusion require so much energy input?
Why? Because you have to overcome the Coulomb barrier.
And fission doesn't require anything.
Right, fission you're already together. So the Coulomb force is effectively working to split it apart as it is, and it's held together by the strong force. If you're able to add a little bit more, it will start to fall apart, and the Coulomb force is pushing it apart, helping the fission happen. For fusion, nothing happens until you get these nuclei close enough to each other that the strong force kicks in, which is very small distance. So it takes tremendous energy to get them that close. So, I don't know if you guys ever remember the cold fusion thing. I know you don't remember, but it came about in late 80s, very early 90s or something, where all of a sudden the New York Times prints this thing that you got a couple of chemists in Utah who claimed that they were getting evidence for fusion by just absorbing tritium or whatever on a heavy metal palladium. You just can't do that. And I remember sitting at the lunch table. I was at Yale in the faculty at the time. And I remember one of my friends, Lawrence Krauss, who's actually a pretty famous guy who writes books now. He was just laughing about it. I mean, literally. He's like, this is such crap. Ah! And of course, it was crap. So, anyway, revolutions in science do happen, but most of them that get published turn out not to be the case. So. Anyway, so that drives fusion. You get that drives The idea is if you take something big and you split it up, you release energy. If you take small things and you add them together, you get energy. And if you have something somewhere here in the middle, you're not going to get energy out of it if you change it very much. So this really is the driving thing. And this is really what drives, conceptually, what's behind nuclear power, weapons, how stars work, and elemental synthesis, in that inside stars you do fusion and gain energy basically on this region, so you can form inside of heavy stars elements up to iron in normal fusion processes, and then you have massive instabilities that can come about and give you supernova, which effectively distributes the heavy elements. It also provides so much energy that you, even though it absorbs energy, you can actually form elements out here that are then distributed into the cosmos and eventually recondense into things like planets and dogs. So I thought it was useful to tell you a bit about how radiation interacts with matter. There are a number of different ways, and it depends on what type of radiation you have, but typically what you have are either photons, gamma rays, or you have charged particles, okay, betas and alphas. If you have a charged particle, one of the primary modes of interaction is that it effectively will interact with an atomic electron, giving it energy and ionizing the atom. So this is the standard way that most charged particles lose energy. This is how we typically detect particles, even at the LHC. When a charged particle goes through a gas, it leaves a trail of ionization. That's a bunch of charge. You can collect the charge and get pulses on wires and stuff and tell where the particle went. If it goes through a scintillating thing, you ionize the atoms. When they recombine, they might emit light. You see the light, etc. So this is a very important thing. When you get at higher energies, the electron and the positron each have 0.511 MeV in energy. So when you're twice that, it turns out that a photon in the electric field of a nucleus, so that you can conserve momentum, actually will pair produce into electrons and positrons, becoming charged particles when you start doing that. Okay. So you get, actually, when you have a very high energy photon, it can interact and you get an electron and positron. They can actually do Bremsstrahlung and give you other photons that can pair produce, etc. So you get things that are called electromagnetic showers of particles. So until all the energy disappears. Compton scattering, you've seen before. Here you have a photon come in and it scatters off an electron and can give you a photon with reduced energy and give kinetic energy to the electron. So these are the primary ways in which matter and radiation interacts with matter. Okay? Exactly how and what happens depends a little bit on the energy. If we look at how photons in particular interact with matter, as a function of the photon energy on a log scale, right? So this would be 100,000 electron volts, and this would be 1,000,000, so that's an MeV, a million electron volts. So as you go up above that, so where you get to about over 1 MeV per photon, you begin to be able to produce pairs of electrons and positrons because you have enough energy. So pair production kicks in as the dominant form for interaction of photons with matter above 1 MeV. There's this region where Compton scattering is very important, and below that, at lower energies, you get photoelectric effect. Alright? And so the photons will go through matter, they'll actually become attenuated. You have attenuation lengths characterized by something called the radiation length in the materials. In different materials, that length will be different. If you have a lot of lead, that attenuation is very short, which is why you shield radiation with lead. Okay? If you use water, it's not as short. If you use air, it's very long. It's a body. Most of the photons will actually go through, but some of them will interact. But you're not going to need to do anything quantitative with that. I just wanted you to realize that you have all these different processes and they have different energy distributions. If you have charged particles, they interact with matter primarily through the ionization. I mean, they have these other techniques too, but as you go to lower energy, so here what I plot is the momentum of the particle, again on a low on a log scale. In this case, it's GeV, so this is 1 GeV. And as you go down in energy, the primary mode for which charged particles lose their energy is ionization. One reason why you care is that if it's your DNA that gets ionized, it can cause damage to your DNA, and that's what gives you cancer if you're exposed to lots of radiation, in part. It also can ionize everything else in the cell and cause the cell to die, which is another way to die from radiation. Okay, so if you get a lot of radiation, you don't die of cancer in 30 years. You die miserably in a few days because a lot of your cells and things are no longer functioning well. All right, so that's the sort of the primary mode. There are a couple of characteristics I really wanted to show you on this particular plot. It's a complicated plot, so let me take you on a tour. So what we're plotting is, this is momentum, lower momentum, higher momentum for the particle. We have lots of different particles. Alpha particles are up here, deuterons, photons, and then particles called kaons, pions, and muons, which I'm going to introduce to you. These plots, these lines, these dashed lines, correspond to what we call ddx. That is, how much energy is deposited per unit length in the material as the particle goes through. Okay? So that means how much energy is it losing as it goes through the material. And one of the things I wanted to point out to you, it turns out to be very important, is that at higher momenta, I'm only showing you part of these curves, it turns out to be fairly flat. As you go to lower momentum, that is, as the particle nears the end of its path, because it's losing energy, the energy loss rises dramatically. This is a log scale, okay? So the particle loses some energy, and then loses a hell of a lot of energy right at the end. Okay, so it's a very important characteristic. The other thing to see is that here is the range, and you may wonder about these crazy units. It's in grams per square centimeter, range. That's because it allows you to deal with different density things. I take the range in grams per square centimeter, and I divide it by the density in grams per cubic centimeter, I get a range in centimeters. So this is sort of the way it's usually presented. So in terms of the range, if I had a given momentum particle of a certain type, so let's take alpha particles, and I have a 1 GeV alpha particle, it has a pretty well-known range. You can calculate it. So I want you to note this rise in the ddx as you go to low momentum, and note that we have alphas are heavy, and they have a high charge. They have a very big energy loss. And they have a short range. Here's the range. Alphas are over here, so they have a short range. Deuterons are heavier than protons, but they have the same charge. Deuterons lose more energy, and they have a shorter range than protons. So there is a mass and charge dependence here. Heavier, more charge, have a shorter range, and a bigger energy loss. And for a given momentum particle, we have a fixed range. So there are lots of things you can do with this. I mean, these are important aspects if you want to identify particles to do things with it. But one of the things that is done, and is very relevant, is how do they interact medically or anti-medically in terms of trying to kill you, right? So, in medically, one of the uses that people use for beams of particles is to irradiate tumors, okay? So, I can take, for example, if I have an X-ray source, a powerful X-ray or gamma source, cobalt-60, I can take it and I can shield it with lead except for a small hole that points in the direction of the tumor. And then I can just point that at your tumor, say in your head or someplace in your body. When that happens, these x-rays or cobalt gamma rays will go through your body, and most of them will pass through, but you have your body will attenuate them, which means some of them will be interacting along this path. They will be destroying tissue along that path. They will destroy tissue throughout this because you will have them reaching this side of the head easily enough. So one of the things that you do is you then change the direction of that beam constantly so that the intersections are always at the tumor. So you're killing some cells here and some cells here, but a lot more here. So that's one of the things you do. If you use charged particles, you can play a totally different game. You can take a heavy ion or a proton beam, for example. You can tune it to be d-momentum where the endpoint of its range is very close to that tumor. And then you send it in, and remember, its energy loss is primarily at the end of its path. So, amazingly, it can go in, and it dumps all its energy right there at the end of the wall chart. So it's a very effective way to kill tumors of certain types and in certain locations. And you do have to worry that it's creaming all this tissue that you're going around, so you might change the direction a little bit too, but it's very nice in the sense that it can be tuned sort of fit the tumor. So this kind of treatments do exist. You may find yourself having to deal with radioactive sources given your line of potential work here. And whether you want to or not, sometimes it's thrust upon you and there are nuclear accidents or whatever. Hopefully that won't become commonplace, but it does happen. So I wanted to give you just a sense of thinking about these things a little bit. There are actually a lot of factors. First of all, as I'll show shortly, you are constantly being bombarded by radiation. Okay, you blow up particles. You have radioactive things inside you, so it's unavoidable. It's really just a matter of degree. Okay, but there are lots of things to consider when you're dealing with radiation. One is, how hot is it? What is the activity? If you're standing beside a nuclear reactor core, it's really active, and you're going to get cooked pretty fast. You have a really small, weak source over here. It's not going to bother you too much because there just aren't many decays, no matter what it is or where it's located. Really. The other thing is distance and proximity, right? It drops off. The intensity will drop off as 1 over r squared. So if you're a little further away, that's a good thing. Proximity to vital organs. It's okay to have your hand irradiated relative to your kidneys. So when you're actually working in the lab with something, put your shield in here, right? And then you can use your hands, and you can get a much higher dose in certain parts of your body. You want to watch out for your corneas and things like that. But exactly how the source is associated with where your vital organs are is very important. Chemical activity. You know, some things are absorbed in the thyroid. Some things are easily water-soluble. Some things just pass up through your body. So if you were to ingest it, you really want to know in what chemical form you ingested it to sort of have some sense of what it's going to do in your body. And one of the ways in which they're used medically is, in fact, you use that kind of thing. You radioactively label a certain material that happens to preferentially congregate near a tumor, and you can use that to radioactively study the location and size of the tumor, or you can use it to burn the tumor itself by having it like be an alpha source, which will hurt the tumor. It depends on where it is and what it is as to how dangerous it is. All of these factors come into play, but also the type of the source. So, for example, alphas are very heavily ionizing. You can stop them with a piece of paper. So outside your body, they're really not that immune for the most part. The shielding is minimal. It's not too bad. But if you ingest an alpha source, when it's inside your body, the alphas are emitted, they have a very short range, and they damage the hell out of everything they touch because they're heavy and they're charged. You know, they cross the double proton. So they're the worst inside the body. Gammas outside your body are very dangerous because they will go through your body and some of them will hit vital organs. And there's no way to really avoid it short of having a big thing of lead. If you drink a gamma source, I mean, that's not good, and they will interact with your body too, but a lot of the gamma rays will go right out. So you blow gamma rays, but it maybe isn't as bad as it sounds, right? So if someone offers you, you know, drink an alpha source or drink a beta source for the same given activity, drink a gamma source, right? Don't drink the alpha source. So there are lots of things you need to consider if you're near radioactive sources. So the distance, the time, both the time for your activity near the source, you plan things, and also distance while you're working on it. Betas are sort of intermediate. They penetrate a little more than alphas. If you're around a beta source, like depleted uranium or something, you can actually get a sunburn, but it won't go inside your body. Okay, anything? There are measurements of this. Your book will tell you about a lot of this stuff. There are different kinds of measurements we need to make, right? Activity is how many decays per second. Clearly something that has more decays per second, a bigger pile of stuff, is more dangerous than a smaller pile of stuff. Then you need to worry about how much is the absorbed dose. As you've already seen, charged particles and photons and even different charged particles distribute different amounts of energy per unit length in a material. And different materials will absorb different amounts. So one of the relevant things is not just what is the activity, but you have to boil it down to what is the particle and what is the actual energy absorption going to be. So there, we use something called absorbed dose, which is usually measured in rads. And so that is the amount of radiation, whatever it happens to be, for this thing that will give you a certain energy per mass of a certain value. So now we start to get particle and material specific. And that will give you the amount of rads. But what's really important for most things we have to worry about is called RIMS. It's the radiation equivalent man. And it's the thing you need to know whether you're going to die or whether it's going to, you know, possibly affect whether you can have healthy children or something like that. And here, it is effectively this dose, so it does depend on how much energy is deposited, but also it depends on something they call quality factor. So this is sort of a measure of how much damage this thing is likely to do to living tissue. And so now, again, you come into play as to what exactly you're doing. And so this has for many years been called RIMS. There's an MKS unit that people are now using. I've noticed for the Fukushima accident, the press has now moved away from RIMS, and they're now talking about the sieverts. The sievert is effectively the dose in units of hundreds of rads times the quality factor. So it's very similar, but a little different from RIMS. In the end, you're not going to even memorize any of these things, but you want to pay attention when you look at a number, you can look at a table to find out what kind of damage things you're talking about. There is a difference between chronic doses and acute doses. If you take a lot of RIM that you have to get because of your job and you spread it over a little bit per day, you have sort of a chronic dose, and that, while not necessarily good, may not be so bad biologically because your body is able to actually repair a lot of things. If you get that same dose, but you get it all in 20 minutes, your body may actually not be able to handle that and do the repairs. And so it can be very different. So again, another factor is the degree of the rate at which you get the dose. But one of the things you'll typically find if you have if you're dealing with sources or any sort of place where you're potentially getting radiation, there'll be generally an annual allowed allotment. And when you read stories about Fukushima, you'll see stories about workers rotating in. Because what happens is they'll literally rotate in and work for a half an hour or an hour until they've literally absorbed their annual dose of allowed work-related radiation, and then they have to get out of there, and then they have to stay away. Otherwise, they're going to be violating run the risk of actually really hurting them. Background radiation is everywhere. It can depend on where you are. You've got higher background radiation around granite, i.e. Manhattan, or Denver, where you're high and you have lots of rock. Okay. You get it from cosmic rays. About 14%, you're constantly being bombarded by muons formed by particles in the upper atmosphere. Radon is a huge thing. So if you go into an unventilated basement, that's not really good. You often ventilate things. What you eat, you will get natural radiation. You can't avoid it. Carbon-14 we've talked about. You breathe it. The nuclear industry in and of itself, even if you integrate it with the accidents, isn't much. As long as you didn't live near Chernobyl, you're probably okay. The medical industry is now giving you a significant dose whenever you go get x-rays or chest x-ray or whatever. I mean, it's not a trivial dose. It doesn't mean it's dangerous. It's just compared to the other stuff that you get. So in terms of the size of the background radiation, average that I used to work with is 130 millirems per year. I just pulled this off of some website yesterday where they're saying average is about 3 millisieverts. So when I convert this to millisieverts, I get about 1. So it's sort of 1 to 3 millisieverts in general. A chest x-ray is 10% of that. Abdominal x-ray is more than that if you have to get it. If you live in Colorado, you're going to get more than that. Full body scan CT, you're getting quite a bit. I was looking, there are some pretty neat tables, and you can find how much you get if you fly a lot. You get a lot more than, if you're in an air loft where you're not being shielded by the atmosphere. Smoking a cigarette, you can ask what kind of activity you get from that, and it's significant. So there are lots of normal daily activities we do that actually can give you a pretty decent dose of radiation compared to what you get when you start to really suffer. So mild radiation sickness, when you're up at a half to a whole sievert, we're talking millisievert up here. So there's a good bit of headroom. Okay? Any questions about this kind of stuff? All right, that's the end of the course. Okay? All right. That wasn't good. I think this thing needs to be rebooted. I was trying very hard not to have to do that. Ooh. Boy, if we get through this, it's going to be good. It's on the edge. I've got the not responding window with the little circle going. Slowly, pieces are starting to appear. I want to take 10 minutes to reboot you. Okay. They would be a little bit down. Is this not coming through? Holy crap. Sorry. It sensed I was in a hurry. Big projector stopped talking to my laptop. Alright, so some of these are dark slides, so sorry. Okay, so I want to talk to you about particle and particle physics and cosmology. And what's interesting to me is it's really a story about sort of this intimate relationship between the very big and the very small in a bizarre sort of way, so I hope I can give you a sense of. I'm going to go fast through parts of it because the slides are prepared for other things and this isn't relevant. We've seen all of it. So, you know, what holds the nucleus together, the way we discover, the way we look at it is to use beams to bash nuclei. You can sort of imagine by trying to figure out how a car works by bashing lots of cars together and looking at the pieces coming out. If you did 1,000 of them in different energies and different types of cars, you'd begin to figure out what is essential for cars, right? You'd begin to, if you collide Volkswagens and Toyotas, you'd still get spark plugs. You'd only get Toyota symbols when you have a Toyota. So you can look for patterns, and instead of race cars, we use accelerators. This is an aerial view of Fermilab. We use big detectors because these particles have lots of energy, so these detectors are absolutely packed with instrumentation that are trying to take advantage of the effects of particles on matter. So we look at ionization and how it varies with charge and mass. We use big magnetic fields so that we can measure the momentum as they go. We literally are doing car crash reconstruction by looking at the characteristics of everything coming out, projecting back to try to figure out what happens. So here's a picture from a three-story cube detector in California that I used to work on. And you can actually see it's got a big magnetic field here, so charged particles are emanating from in here. You can see them curving due to the magnetic field. They're actually passing through a can of gas here where, as they ionize, the gas drifts and electric fields to the nearest wires and we get signals. So these are reconstructed out of thousands of little space points where we get charges on wires. And then there are other types of devices where we destroy the particle. We effectively have so much material the particle is destroyed and we measure energy. But I'm not going to waste time talking about that today. The kinds of questions we want to know is, you know, what is the nature of matter? What forces exist in nature? If you're sending particles to one another, all of a sudden you have to ask, what does it mean when they interact with one another? And as you go up in energy, as we're going to see, because we believe that the universe used to be hotter and denser, as we go up in energy, we're really exploring how matter and forces differ in the earlier parts of the universe. And so quite literally, this gets tied in with questions about how the universe evolved. So this you've already seen. We've talked about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. The part that's of interest to us is that we have, remember, this form of Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It basically says that weird things can happen as long as they happen over very short times. So this particle can kick out a virtual particle, which maybe does an electron and positron and comes back together. As long as this happens over such a short time, I'm none the wiser. It's a process that's allowed in quantum mechanics. So you might ask, if I have two particles and they each have these so-called virtual particles around them, what happens when one virtual particle is absorbed by the other particle, not the one that was initially produced? These particles can contain charge and momentum, so if one of the particles comes from this one and gets absorbed by that one, then it's an exchange of a virtual particle, which can carry charge and momentum, change in momentum with respect to time is a force. And this is the force, the conceptual view of what a force is in the area of physics we call quantum field theory. It may sound Harry Potterish and ridiculous, but since quantum mechanics really is a sum over all possibilities, the fact that these possibilities are open within quantum mechanics and Heisenberg and circuit principles, you have to take them into account. And it turns out that it works in terms of how forces work. So what accounts for the different forces is the different particles that absorb and emit them, as well as what type of particle gets exchanged. So in terms of the fundamental particles, so there's a lot of history here that I'm skipping over, which is pretty fun, but I don't have time to do it. We believe fundamentally in the universe right now. There are sort of three different categories of particles. One category, they're called leptons, and the electron you're very familiar with. And we've even seen a little bit about the electron neutrino. It turns out that if you look in nature, we seem to have two more things that are very electron-like, but high of energy, the muon and the tau. And they each come also with associated neutrinos. Collectively, we call these leptons, which basically the Greek word meaning lightweight, because the electron, when it was discovered, was light compared to some of the other particles we've discovered. In addition, we have fundamental particles called quarks, which we've not talked at all about in this class, but quarks make up protons and neutrons, for example. And so if you look and you do effectively a Rutherford scattering experiment on protons, you'll find that you have scattering off of particles inside the proton, seeing how that a charge one-third or two-thirds and contain only a fraction of the momentum of the most of the proton. And this is evidence of your scattering substructure. And when we call these things quarks, Ari Bodek's thesis was effectively discovery of quarks. And Friedman and Kendall and Taylor won the Nobel Prize in 1972 for basically Ari's thesis, if you know Ari Bodek. In addition, we have particles that get exchanged. So these are virtual particles, so that's why they're called the force carriers here. The photon is one of which you're very, very familiar with. Each of the particles have antiparticles, which I'm not going to spend time in. Basically, an antiparticle is the same electric charge and magnetic moment. And a way to think about the reason we have to have antiparticles is if you have some energy sitting here, it can turn into a particle and an antiparticle very nicely in the vacuum, virtually, as long as they come back together. But that can only happen if you conserve charge. So if you have a positive one, you better have a negative one too. So there's a symmetry that you end up with in nature. Why we are matter and not antimatter, we don't know yet. That's actually a current area of investigation that Ari and Kevin McFarlane and I are all three working on in neutrino physics these days. To give you a sense of how these forces work and depend on the particle, let's look at the electromagnetic force. So this is electromagnetism like you've never really seen it before. In electromagnetism, the fundamental process for the force is an exchange of a virtual photon. So to get a sense of what that means, photons can have an infinitesimal energy. So I can have a virtual photon that has almost no energy. If that's true, it means it can exist for a relatively long time, and at the speed of light, it can go a very long distance. So from that thinking, the electromagnetic force has an infinite range. Okay? The weak nuclear force, you have an exchange of a particle called a W or a particle called a Z. The W is charged, so this electron goes into an electron neutrino. If this were quarks, this might be a proton changing to a neutron, for example, but I have it scattering off the neutrinos here. The W is charged and Z is neutral. It could be either one, but they're very heavy. They have a mass, and these are fundamental particles like a photon. They have a mass that is as big as about 90 protons. They're massive particles. They're bigger than some nuclei, right? Lots of nuclei, actually. So they are a huge mass.
if that particle which carries this force has that big a mass, if I'm going to have one created as a virtual particle, that means delta E in Heisenberg's uncertainty principle has to be huge, which means delta T is really small. If delta T is really small, even if this particle is moving at the speed of light, it goes a very, very short distance, which means particles very seldom come close enough to each other for the weak interaction, that is the exchange of a virtual WZ, to ever happen. So the weak nuclear force is not a weak force per se, it's a very short range force. So you never get close enough, hardly, for it to ever happen. But it does happen sometimes. So once in a while, if you're playing darts, you'll actually hit the bullseye. But most of the time, you won't. And so this is why, for example, neutrinos almost never interact with matter, because they only interact via the weak interaction. Then there's the strong nuclear force, which is a pretty bizarre force. So I'm going to tell you more about that in a second. So the forces have very characteristic ranges. So the weak force has a very small range. Gravity, if it exists, we know the graviton, which would be the particle you would exchange, has to have has to be massless because it has to have an infinite range. Another strangeness, I think we talked a little bit about with quantum field theory, the vacuum becomes a very complicated place. Right, it's not nothing. It's a seething sea of particle and antiparticle pairs in any given instant. And you may not think much about it, but if you're an electron trying to pass through the vacuum, you might be interacting with some of those fleetingly existing quantum particles. And that can actually make corrections on the kinds of things that you observe. And we need to remember the vacuum now has some reality to it. So when we start talking about making something out of nothing, it's not quite as crazy as you might initially think. There are lots of other particles that I have not mentioned because they are not fundamental. So there are two primary categories of particles that we can form from quarks. One group, they're called baryons. Baryon is Greek for heavy. And it includes protons and neutrons. So if I take two up quarks, the up quark has a plus two-thirds charge. The down quark has a minus one-third charge. If I have two plus two-thirds and one minus third, I have a plus one, and I have a proton. If I have UDD, I end up with a neutral particle and have a neutron. I can form a quark and an antiquark pair, and the kinds of particles that we see are called pions, kaons, and lots of others. So there's entire books of these kinds of particles, their excited states, different masses, etc. So these quarks, they're now in a bound state, they can have angular momentum, you can talk about orbitals. But in this case, how the different energy states for the quarks manifest itself is literally different mass particles giving different quantum states of these sorts of things. The strong force, I promised you, is sort of strange. The truth is we've never actually seen a bare quark. We've only had evidence of scattering off of quarks. And the reason is because the strong force gets very strong very fast. And the fundamentally why that is that the particle that's exchanged, which is called the gluon, actually carries the charge of the force. In electromagnetism, I have two charged particles that exchange a photon. The photon has no charge. So it turns out that if you analyze a force like that and you pull the two particles apart, that force gets weaker as you pull them apart. If the particle that's exchanged also carries the force, it turns out if you try to pull the two particles apart, it gets stronger and stronger. So when you look at the strong nuclear force, which goes by the name quantum chromodynamics, the quantum theory of the electric field is called quantum electrodynamics, QED. If we talk about the force between quarks, it's the strong force, and there are three different charges. And just like in electromagnetism, where I have the two charges plus and minus an atom together and have a neutral thing that no longer feels the force, in QCD, I have three color charges. Sounds pretty weird. Red, blue, and green. If I add them together, I have a colorless state, and it doesn't feel the strong force anymore. And that's why you have baryons, which are three quark states. They're all three of different colors. You put them together, and you have a state that's stable with respect to the strong force. You have another bound state, which is a quark and an anti-quark, so then you have a color and an anti-color, and again, give you a colorless state. So it's sort of strange that there's this color analogy with the charges and the strong force, so that's why the name is quantum chromodynamics, or QCD. In this theory, it turns out that as I try to separate two colored particles, the force between them, the relative strength of the force between them, becomes greater and greater and greater. You get a pretty weird effect when that happens, because if I were to try to kick a quark out of another particle, which is our sort of conventional way of trying to see particles, so imagine I have a proton, which is a three different colored quarks in it, so it's effectively a colorless state, and it's bound, and now I come along and I decide that I want to kick one of these protons really hard so that I can see a bare proton. Note that as you pull these things apart, this energy in this tube between them becomes greater and greater. In fact, the energy density along that tube becomes so great that it becomes energetically favorable to pull another quark and anti-quark out of the vacuum and form two colorless particles instead of a bare quark. And this is something which we call confinement, and it accounts for why quarks are confined into protons and into neutrons, but it's a pretty bizarre thing as far as the strong force is concerned. So this means that the bare strong force in and of itself has a limited range and is sort of confined within the size of these various things, although fundamentally it has a far long enough range. If you have it that strong, you just create other particles. Do you have a question?
Yeah. Does the light pi 0 proceed to pop out the distance?
Yeah. I mean, you've given it now energy. I mean, one way to think about it is if I use energy and I put it into a system, I literally, what the theorists would say, I bring the virtual particles on shell. I give them enough energy that I satisfy Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, allowing them to exist for all time. So that's sort of a picture of what you do when you're using a particle accelerator. So, yeah, if you put enough energy in the system, you literally are creating. If I hit a proton hard enough, I will generate a shower of other particles, pions and kaons and protons and stuff. And they come from this kind of process, which makes studying strong interaction really hard to do, because in fact you have this statistical process of fragmentation into other particles. So what you actually see are jets of particles, which I might have a pretty picture here for you. No, I don't. I think actually the picture I showed you earlier, we had an event that had one at the end of this. We can go back if you remind me. I don't want to do it now for fear of how much this is misbehaving at the moment. I don't want to pull it out of this particular display mode. I talked about briefly the fact that the force that actually holds the nucleus together isn't really the strong force per se. It's not QCD at its barest level, which I just described to you. The actual force that binds nucleons together in a nucleus is a similar thing, but the exchange force is actually it's exchanging pion. So you can sort of think of this as a neutron, this is a proton, and these are held together by these little squiggly ones, which represent the exchange of gluons. But you can have processes represented like this, and this is now a quark and anti-quark particle, which is held, and that's a pion. If you were to take the range or the size of the nucleus, say 10 to the minus 15 meters, and say, okay, if something moves the speed of light, 10 to the minus 15 meters, well, how much time does it exist? And then from that, calculate the energy it has, you can effectively get the mass of the exchanged particle between these nucleons. And when you do this, you get something that's on the order of the mass of the pion. And that's the thing that sort of binds the nucleons themselves together. There were a couple of questions up here. So, yeah.
Yeah. So when you're pulling, was it baryon apart? Like, when you're actually trying to pull the quark out, Is there any, when the meson is created, is there any energy release that it's all countable, or that is it all countable to the amount of energy required to pull it apart? Like, is there any way to generate any useful energy from that?
Well, that's a good question. Not that, you know, you get out what you put in that case. Yeah.
I was trying to think of something.
Yeah. Right. I mean, part of the issue is, if there were a bunch of matter that you found actually living in an excited state, and you could somehow hit it and cause it to go into a lower energy mass state or something, then perhaps you'd have a mode of trying to have energy generation. I don't really, everything's in its ground state, generally. And so when you put energy in, you sort of get what you put out, and you don't get more the way you do in nuclear physics. Yeah.
I just wanted to know if this process is repeatable, like the part we pull out.
It's a statistical process, so you have to do high statistics, and then you can sort of understand the things that happen. But if I hit one proton with a particle really hard, and I get a jet of particles coming out, and I do it again with the same energy particle, I will get a jet of particles coming out, and it will share some of the characteristics, but it may not, you know, it won't look exactly the same.
I mean, like, would you be able to find, like, what makes up a neon?
Yeah, there are ways to. I mean, there are ways to do that, but I mean, you do conserve momentum, you do conserve charge. You can try to mix different things. So there are ways to try to infer. I mean, there are reasons why we think we know what quarks are in kinons, but probably deeper than we want to go into. Yeah.
How do we define in this picture, like, what is the proton and what is the neutron? Because it seems like you just have a sea of an up, down, up, down, down, and up quark.
Yeah, so that's what these lines are supposed to mean. I'm sort of drew it to sort of say that these are where these quarks are isolated. So within the nucleus, generally speaking, you have associations like this and this and this and this.
So they are like separate entities? They're not just jumbled in there a bunch of quarks?
It's fair enough that lower energies you can think of it as separate entities. But if I take two nuclei and I shoot them at each other at really, really, really high energies, they literally look like bags of quarks to each other, and it's not so much that you see in the neutrons per se.
This is really amazing, but how come? I think that was the column that I said, folks.
But these are fermions. These are all fermions, so it doesn't all condense into one state.
Oh, okay.
Which is probably good. Otherwise, life wouldn't be interesting. So, just to summarize, you know, we have the quarks, we have the leptons, we have the gauge bosons. If we ask what is normal matter made of, it's really just this lepton. You have baryons, but really you just have in ground state matter these combinations of the quarks that form nuclei, and you add that to electromagnetic radiation. The photon is necessary to hold this together for electromagnetic force, and the gluon sort of holds these hadrons together, and that's sort of the strange picture we have. So it may seem a little bit weird, and I'm summarizing 70 years of scattering particles of different sorts off of other things to sort of get to this picture. But the picture that I just described to you with the fundamental particles that I just described to you really came about in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And we now call it the standard model of particle physics. We might call it the electroweak unification. The standard model really involves the electromagnetic force, the weak force, and the strong force all together. There was the strong force was developed sort of a little later, sort of in the 70s and 80s, and the electromagnetic and the weak force were unified in the early 1970s through something which we call electroweak unification. One reason I want to bring this up is you might actually recognize this guy who walks around the physics department here. So one of the six guys who were responsible for the theory that I'm going to tell you about lives here, and Carl Hagen. So there are other players. So these guys actually predicted a theoretical mechanism that was then used by these three guys to unify what we think of as the electromagnetic force and the strong force. And you think, what do you mean by unification? Well, when you learned about electromagnetism, actually when humanity learned about electromagnetism, right, how did you do it? You learned about the electricity, you studied it, you quantified it, you come up with things like Coulomb's law. You learn about magnetism. But they're sort of different beasts. And it's at a different level that you begin to learn how interrelated they are, but we didn't unify them and see that they're sort of different faces of the same thing. I mean, at one level you could say it was Maxwell, but even Maxwell sort of had them separate, but they could interrelate. And it's not really until Einstein shows that they really are, relativistically, only different faces of the same thing. So we would say that's a unification of electromagnetism, electricity and magnetism, okay? Here we sort of have the same thing that happened. So what happened was we talked a little bit about beta decay and the fact that if you have a two-body decay, say the neutron into a proton and an electron comes out, based on the mass differences, you can tell what the energy distribution of that electron will be. And we know that it's smeared out, and so we can understand that by making the three-body decay and having a neutrino in there. And people basically were able to describe beta decay okay with this. Fermi did this. It's a nice theory. At the same time, as you well know, Maxwell has a pretty good theory of the electromagnetic interaction, and Richard Feynman and others sort of pulled that into the quantum world with quantum electrodynamics. And you know, all these people I'm naming are winning Nobel Prizes for this work, right? So it's not, this is pretty serious stuff. Theoretically, these theories individually sort of work, but they had a very, very fundamental problem, which was internally, they only actually work for massless particles. So if you said the electron actually has mass, then the theory actually doesn't hold together. So there was clearly something wrong here, and people didn't understand it. It turns out, and the six guys, all the guys I showed you on this last page basically played parts in this. It turns out that if you write a description that includes the weak interaction and the electromagnetic interaction, more or less in the form that we see here, and you add to it ad hoc another particle which has certain characteristics, which is called, nowadays we call it the Higgs particle, you can sort of mathematically mix these and make some choices, which we call spontaneous symmetry breaking, that I'm not going to get into. And what happens is this theory gets transformed into one where the particles can be massive, so it allows for the particles to have mass, and it makes the prediction for some very particular things, such as it tells you the exact masses and properties of the W and the Z particle that are exchanged in the weak interaction, as well as the properties of the photon. And it tells you everything else, pretty much. If I take a pion and I zap a proton with it really hard, and I want to calculate the probability of different things happening, or an angular distribution or whatever, this theory gives it to me. This is known as the standard model. And it may seem sort of a wacky theory, probably wackier than you can understand by me telling you about it now, except that it really works. I mean, to a gnat's eyebrow, it explains everything that we see in electromagnetism, everything we see in beta decay, everything. It's really an amazing theory. I think I last used these slides or the equivalent of them last summer. And at that point, we had never seen the Higgs. But now we have. So the world is changing. LHC has discovered the Higgs, we believe, or a Higgs, at about 125 GeV. Exactly, right now a lot of the excitement is exactly what kind of particle is this Higgs. So what we know is that something does what the Higgs does in the standard model, but it could take many different forms, and those forms might tell us what happens at much higher energies and what underlies the standard model itself. The standard model by itself, I probably don't have time to go into many of the questions, but it turns out to leave a lot of questions. For example, I told you about the fact that we have electrons and muons and taus, and we have up and down, charms, strings, and top and bottom quarks. They mathematically really come in sort of almost complete sets, of which there are three. It turns out we need the three, but we don't know why we have three. The up quark is pretty light. The top quark weighs about 180 GeV, so it's about 180 protons. The W and Z, we don't know why these masses are the way they are. Why is a muon 2,000 times heavier than an electron? So there are lots of unanswered questions in the standard model, and the hope is that when we really study and understand the Higgs, we may get clues as to things that lie underneath the standard model and can answer some of these questions. So that's sort of one of the big goals in particle physics these days. The W and Z were discovered in the mid-80s, and they were discovered, then studied in gory detail at experiments at CERN and at Stanford. I was on this one. And we would study, we literally created Z's in the laboratory and watched them decay. And there's a picture of one. And we studied the properties in gory detail, and we found they fit the standard model exactly. So that's why the search for the Higgs became so important. In a sense, the standard model is right. So we have to understand everything we can about it. So now I want to move on to the very big and give you a sense of where some of this stuff holds together. As you look farther out, you're looking at processes that happened long ago because light takes time to travel to us. So telescopes are sort of time machines. And I guess we've already discovered, let me not spend time on this, we've already discovered the fact that as we look at, we've discussed a little bit the fact that as we look further out in the universe, it appears that things are moving faster and faster away from us. And so there are different ways to make that measurement, but the way that it's really done these days is you look at something way out in the universe, you look at its spectra, you see how much they're redshifted, and from the redshift you can determine the recessional velocity, and you can then plot that versus the distance, and the distance you get by looking at supernova in those distant objects. And the supernova, by virtue of how fast their light turns on and off, we understand enough by supernova that we can take that timing and determine from that the absolute brightness. And then from the absolute brightness, we know the distance. So we can then plot the distance versus the velocity, and this is a fairly modern set of data. I guess not anymore, but it was. And you can see that it's quite linear and over large distances. And these are megaparsecs, and a megaparsec is a big distance. So so we say that we live in the expanding universe. Why? Because things are moving away from us. But to get a sense of it, it's not like we live in an explosion, okay? What we're saying is that space itself is expanding, okay? And that's why I say more like a butt than a zip. As you get older, your butt gets bigger. It's like from within. And it's the same thing in the universe. And a way to think about it is imagine that the universe starts out as raisin bread dough, and then the dough rises. And think about what happens if you look at two adjoining raisins. If you see two adjoining raisins, they'll move apart with time. Sure. But if you look at the raisins that are farther apart, they'll move apart, but they'll move apart faster because there's more dough between them that's expanding. And so that's why, as you look in the universe, the further out you look, the faster things are accelerating from us. So that's the picture, is that that data tells us that the universe itself, the space within the universe itself, is expanding. So if you extrapolate back,
I mean, the obvious thing is you must have had a starting point, right? The space must have started small and it's expanded. And we call this process the Big Bang. So the paradigm today is called the Hot Big Bang Theory. And here are some of the players, because you really have to understand how something large works with gravity in order to give you the large scale structure of the universe. How does the theory of expansion actually happen? And then how do we get the stuff that we see inside it coming out of that theory? Yes?
What's the mass space?
What's what?
What's, can you go back to the previous thing? So what's the space surrounding liquid space? Is that like a pure vacuum where there's no like virtual particles? Is that like a real vacuum? And how that to get out?
Yeah. One, I probably can't give you a good answer. But to the extent that I were to stumble and try, I mean, I think that one, we'd end up probably talking more about string theory-ish type things, which I'm, one, no expert, and two, I don't want to take time to do right now. If you want to chat after class, we can, well, you'll have to come by and grab me at some point, because I have an appointment to you today with the speaker for the Pokemon. I'm not trying to evade. Although I will confess, I probably really can't give you a good answer to that. Just go with it for right now. Okay. No, sorry. I'm giving you the wrong answer. That's right. You're when someone asks you something and you can't give them a good answer, if you're in a position of power like me, you've got to look at them and you're going to say, how the hell did you get into this college? And then, you know, that way it sort of goes away. You don't confess your ignorance. It's all much better that way. So, you know, there we go. All right, so if you have this crazy idea of the Big Bang, and you think about it going backwards, okay, then the universe used to be hot and dense. And it goes all the way back to a point. Because you're basically putting infinite energy into a smaller and smaller space, and there's nothing within gravity theory to tell you that you don't go. So here's the basic idea. Magic happens, and we have space-time expanding. I'll talk about that point in a minute. But let us just take for granted that something happens. I mean, remember, you run into lots of troubles, right? If you go to infinite density, all physics we know breaks down. So you have a lot of problems that when you go to a singularity. But what does happen is, imagine if I have accelerators, remember, I'm going back in time because I'm looking at things at higher and higher energies. And it turns out that we are probing with our accelerators things that happened about 10 to the minus 20 seconds after the Big Bang started. So we are able, in the laboratory, to achieve that kind of stuff. So when we talk about what happens along here, it's not it's pulled out of thin air, as you might think. Right here, it's a little bit dicier, and I'll tell you a lot about that. But, for example, if you imagine what happens is we have very high energies. We started out with so much energy that the masses of particles, even the very heavy particles, were effectively light compared to the energy of the interaction. So we have sort of a primordial soup of fundamental particles, including quarks. But at this time, the energy density of this medium is so great, the strong interaction is effectively weak, which means you have no protons, you have no neutrons. At about 1 microsecond after the Big Bang, the energy density in the universe falls to about what we have on the inside of a proton. At that point, the free quarks and gluons will condense into protons and neutrons. We called this beforehand a quark-gluon plasma. When you have condensation happens, we now have a universe filled with free neutrons and protons and photons. And this phase transition is studied in heavy ion physics, and in fact being studied right now at the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider and the LHC.
During this period, the free neutrons are decaying, but as you expand and cool, sometimes they stick to protons. So during this period, you're actually beginning to form some of the light elements. In the meantime, the free neutrons are decaying away, and you end up with some light nuclei, and you have a lot of hydrogen, a lot of protons. Okay, but right now it's still very hot. It's too hot for neutral atoms to exist because you have very highly energetic things happening. So if you were to form a neutral atom, it just gets ionized immediately. But that changes at about 300,000 years after the Big Bang, where the universe cools to about 3,000 degrees. And at that point, neutral atoms can begin to form. This turns out to be a very important point in the universe because prior to that, if you were a photon floating around the universe and there were plenty of photons because it was very hot, you didn't go very far, because if you try to send a photon in a plasma with charged particles, it has a short interaction limit. So the way to think about it is, if you see light from this time, what you see is something glowing, but you get no image, if you want to think of it that way, because it's like looking through frosted glass. The light is getting scattered all over the place, okay? Then, all of a sudden, you cool off enough that the universe turns into neutral particles. And now, all the photons that are floating around in the universe, all of a sudden, the interaction link becomes infinite. And they just go. And that is what we now see as the cosmic microwave background. Okay, the universe is filled with radiation at this point, 300,000 years after we started the Big Bang. And all of a sudden, the universe becomes transparent, and those photons just travel forever. And they're still there. They're hitting you now. So we asked lots of questions. So why do you believe this crap? One is that if you go and you look at this glow of radiation that we see in our universe, it is a perfect black body. It's coming from everywhere. And the temperature is exactly what you would expect if it happened at 3,000 degrees 300,000 years after the Big Bang. That's pretty amazing, if you think about it. This was discovered by accident. These guys thought it was bird shit in their radio wave, actually, their radio telescope, and it turned out it wasn't. They tried everything they could think of. They couldn't get rid of it. And then some guys at Princeton said, oh, we were just about to build an experiment to look for it, and you guys already discovered it. I'm sure it didn't make their day when they heard about it. But anyway, the cosmic microwave background was seen in 1964. Another thing that's happened is it's not trivial astronomy. The astronomers are able to look at the distribution of elements, light elements in the universe. So here I have the fraction of various light elements as a function of the temperature in the universe in the early, early universe. And I know you can hardly read this, if at all, but this is hydrogen. This is helium. This is helium-3. This is boron, etc. And basically, if you take the pot of the universe at that, from about 1 microsecond up to about 3 minutes of all those protons and neutrons, and you let it cook for 3 minutes, out comes these curves, theoretically. And note that after about 3 minutes, which you can't read, but it turns out this is about 3 minutes, these ratios are roughly stable. So the boron, the beryllium to hydrogen, the helium to hydrogen ratio are pretty solidly predicted by this model. And lo and behold, if you go and you look and you try to determine these abundances in intergalactic space, which astronomers have sort of figured out how to do in different ways, you find exactly what you're predicting. So we call this Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and it gets the right answer. So there are reasons to believe in the Big Bang. But if you believe in the Big Bang, then we got some real serious problems. One of which is we talked about the fact, and we talked a little about general relativity, and the fact that space can be curved, and that's a way to interpret gravity. Turns out that within general relativity, there's no preference for So the fact is, we seem to live in a universe which has a geometry that's roughly flat. Why should it be that way? In the Big Bang, there's nothing that we know of that says that. There are bigger problems. The Big Bang in and of itself has this singularity where all physics breaks down. So what are you going to do with that? Another is called the horizon problem. If we look at the cosmic microwave background way over here, and we look at it way over here, we get the same temperature. We see the same black body spectrum, which means they were causally connected at some point. But in the Big Bang theory in and of itself, those points in the universe were never causally connected. So why should this point know what temperature that point should be? This is known as the horizon problem. It's a very serious problem because it basically means science as we know it is inconsistent with the Big Bang. So, there's also the large-scale structure problem. If you just take the Big Bang, you sort of have something going kablooey, everything is uniform. So, where do you get the non-uniformities that eventually turn into us and dogs, and planets and galaxies and stuff? So, the large-scale structure problem is a big problem. So, where does all this come from? Well, it comes from something which we call cosmic inflation, which if it's not the weirdest idea you've ever heard, just wait. The idea is that the universe starts out very small, some sort of a, you might just say, an energy quantum fluctuation, okay? There are, if you were to do that and you ask what are the characteristics of space, if you just have a fluctuation in there, you can get lots of different answers. And it turns out that some of those answers are quite unstable and in fact can have a really fast, superluminal, incredibly big expansion happening in the space-time, which is called cosmic inflation. It actually turns out to conserve energy in a weird sort of way, because if you take this thing, it takes energy to do this, but at the same time, you are creating negative gravitational potential energy, and the two basically cancel out. So one of the guys, Alan Booth, is famous for having said, there is a free launch after all. Basically, our universe is sort of this free launch. So the idea is that you have this, however it started or however it's driven, you have this massively fast expanding space. As it expands, you will have quantum fluctuations in energy, which are then stretched out much faster than superluminal, right? So any fluctuation I have in energy here is immediately stretched up to cosmic scale. And that gives you energy patterns, difference, non-uniformities in the space-time as it gets very big. You can then have, in this expanding, superluminally expanding, inflating space, you can have a quantum fluctuation in what's going on in that point in space-time. In string theory, it would be sort of a quantum fluctuation in the structure of extra dimensions or something, if you want to know what they think. But when that happens, you can take the space-time, which has a characteristic of expanding really fast, and actually cause it to expand much slower, or even contract, potentially. So you have a quantum fluctuation in this expanding space-time, which causes this to slow down, and you now have slowly expanding space. Some of the energy that's in this big expansion literally gets dumped into radiation and heat inside that little expanding space. And what you have literally here is something that we see as a Big Bang. But now, in this case, you've had these causally connected pieces from that initial quantum fluctuation blown up to cosmic size. You've got structure because you've got non-uniformities in energy, and you have very specific predictions for what the sizes of these kinds of non-uniformities might be. And once you get this piece started with the quantum fluctuation and giving you the slower expansion, it might be very much bigger than our observable universe, but it basically maps directly onto Big Bang theory. So I just described this sort of inflationary stuff that's thought to happen at really, really short times. But once it maps on, from here on, it's sort of physics we understand. We see it in accelerators. We have a pretty decent idea of what's going on. So is this idea complete crap? Remember that it fixes all the... I haven't really gone through it that carefully, but it fixes all the problems with the Big Bang. And I won't take the time to go through it, but it basically, if you have a ball that's curved and you blow it up to be very big, it looks flat. So if you have space has any arbitrary curvature and you blow it up with inflation, the geometry is going to look flat. So it answers the flatness problem. Initially, everything was causally connected. And even now you blow it big, so it looks like it wasn't causally connected. Initially with inflation, it was. So you answer the horizon problem. We now have a reason that we have the structure, and we even have predictions for what it should look like. And in a sense, you never really have a singularity. You start out with something that is a quantum fluctuation. So this is the new paradigm, even though it sounds sort of crazy. What are the kinds of things we've seen recently? Well, one is that in the last 15 years, we have actually seen fluctuations in the temperature of the cosmic microwave background, which means we have evidence that there were non-uniformities in the universe as early as the 300,000 years after the Big Bang. And the size of those non-uniformities is 1 part in 10 to the 5th. And we're able to look at the pattern of those non-uniformities, and it turns out that it's consistent with this crazy idea of inflation. And I'll show you the data that shows that in a moment. We have discovered from this looking at these patterns that the universe is flat, and we've also discovered, and this was a total surprise, that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. So what do I mean when I say it's flat? This is a picture of the cosmic microwave background taken by a very sensitive device, false color, and the color variations correspond to temperature differences about 1 part in 10 to the 5th. So if you want to say, what are the non-uniformities in the universe that we see, that's what we see. This is a picture of effectively a picture of the light that was in the universe at 300,000 years after the Big Bang. And you can see that the temperature is not uniform, which means when it cools and condenses into things, you will have non-uniformities in the amount of matter that you have, and this is what will give you the condensations that give you planets and galactic clusters and such. So you have this kind of thing is the way people look at it. We can actually measure the geometry of space by looking at the size of these fluctuations using this kind of game. You have a theory that tells you what you think the size of the fluctuations are, and then you go out and measure it, and it will give you a measure of the geometry of the universe. If the universe is flat, you'll measure something that looks like that. If the universe has a positive curvature, you'll measure that. Your spots are bigger, and if you have negative, you'll have smaller spots. So we can go and look at the size of the spot structure on the cosmic microwave background and literally measure whether the universe is flat or not. We find it is flat. In addition, we've discovered that there's a big surprise in that there's a lot of matter that we can't even account for. We don't see, except in a strange sort of way. It was noticed in the 1930s and then again in the 1950s. What people found is if you look at the rotation rates of stars around the centers of galaxies, you can't explain it using the distribution of mass that we can see and associate with luminous things. So it seems that there's a gravitational effect that is about 10 times bigger than what we can account for. And we call this, we say that this is due to some form of matter that doesn't interact electromagnetically, but interacts only gravitationally. And we call it dark matter. Here's another piece of evidence for it. These are galactic clusters that have passed through each other, and these are X-rays that come from the normal matter that was in these clusters when they passed through each other. You can actually figure out the distribution of the mass by looking at the bending of light going around them. And it turns out that where the mass is and where the normal matter is are different once these things pass through each other. So people think this is dark matter. I'm running late, sorry. You can look at the sizes of the spots on the microwave background and use different theories to predict what the various sizes should be. And when you do that, you can get estimates of how much dark matter and dark energy and stuff that we have. And it turns out that that we believe that the matter that we know of is a relatively small fraction of all the energy in the universe. In fact, most of it is dark matter and dark energy. And these are the puzzles that we're trying to ferret out. So I'm out of time. I was going to talk a little bit about multiverses, but I guess I shouldn't. Anyway, if you're interested and you want, I can talk to you for a few minutes. But thanks for listening.